Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, good evening, everybody. This is Dick Staub, host of the Kindling's Muse. I want to thank you for joining us. Those of you listening by podcast, we are broadcasting live from Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. And next time you're in Seattle, you should stop in and visit the good folks here. Mike Hale actually happens to be at the show tonight. And sometime we'll have to have Mike tell the story about this place. It's an amazing, amazing place. And we're so glad to be here. And we're here tonight for our Christmas special, second annual, which is a great opportunity for different thoughtful creatives that are part of the Seattle community to kind of share some of their work with us tonight. And we're also going to have a ukulele grand finale, which is something you all want to hold your breath and look forward to, particularly since it's going to be five out of six ukulele players who have never played the ukulele before. It's all part of the excitement. But it's going to be just a lot of fun, and we are particularly pleased tonight to have with us up here on the at the round table the lovely Jenny Spohr, who is the producer of the Kindling's Muse. She is also an ordained Presbyterian clergy person and a mother of Sienna, who is 3 months old. Can we have a big round of applause for Jenny? Jenny has come out of hibernation, and she's been on maternity leave, and we're so glad to have her back and standing upright. Exactly. And clothed and in her right mind.
You're doing the mommy sway with me, Dick. We're both rocking. Look at us.
I'm just trying to get in touch with my feminine
That's
side,
right.
Jenny.
That's right.
You've always helped me in that way.
That's good.
It's very special. And then we also have with us a guest that has actually left the country as a result of being on this show. good friend Bill Hogg, who's a Scotsman. And just yesterday, Grant at our church up on Orcas Island revealed to us that Thomas Cahill is wrong, that the Irish didn't save civilization, that it's the Scots that saved civilization.
That's absolutely correct, Dick. I'm glad you're getting some pure theology up there on Orcas Island.
Well, actually, he actually said that the Scots are responsible for the Enlightenment, which is really, really hard. I don't know how you make that case. But
Well, when you look at the Industrial Revolution, all the intellectual horsepower was Scottish.
Well, their horse is associated with the word that I would think of for the Scottish. But it wouldn't be horsepower.
Metaphorical. We're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen, while I lay hands on Dick Staub. That's what we're going to do.
Okay. Well, anyway, I decided to introduce Bill tonight as a pastor and humorist. And we're not sure it's in that order. But Bill, you've left us too. You've gone north.
That's right. I'm just the other side of the border in what's known as the Great White North, and enjoying life in Canada. What else do you want me to tell you? I'm just barely inside the border. I've managed to dodge Interpol, the CIA, and the FBI, and I've got my high secure hog lair just across the border in Canada.
A hog lair?
Yes. Yeah, it's a bit like a bat cave, only it's more environmentally friendly. You know, that's the difference.
Oh, but now, correct me if I'm wrong, which I usually am, of course.
Yeah, you were wrong already, so we're at least there's consistency.
This goes without saying. Well, this morning, I have to tell you, I was at a Starbucks, and I was charging up a card for my lovely daughter who's here tonight. She's going on an urban plunge. She hasn't showered for 2 days. Because she's getting ready to actually be a homeless person on the streets. But my wife thought she should have a Starbucks card while she was out on the streets. So I was recharging her Starbucks card, and I accidentally dropped my American Express with the card and the receipt into the trash and then couldn't find it. Didn't know I had done this. So I actually had to have people helping me empty the trash at Starbucks. And I said, look, let's face it, folks. We all need help. Just it's more obvious with some of us than others. You know, so that's the case, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely. In your case,
I would say
there's empirical evidence that some need help more than others. And I need help because I'm downwind of your street person daughter at this point in time.
And of course, I will never be forgiven for pointing out that the lovely daughter has not showered for 2 days. But let's face it, nobody in our family showers anyway. So, I mean, you know, the truth is really coming out tonight, and the truth shall set you free. Well, so anyway, now back to Jenny, just for the briefest of moments. How are you doing?
I'm, you know, trying to keep a binky in a mouth over here.
Keep a
maybe
what?
Maybe a binky in a mouth, a maybe binky. In yours, but no, in hers.
So the baby is 3 months old.
3 months and 2 weeks.
And how did it go?
Specific.
How did they? When last we saw you, you were great with
it
child.
Was painful.
It was painful.
I don't know.
I'm probably the only
goes.
Man in broadcasting that has talked about his wife's episiotomy on the air.
Yeah, yeah.
And lived to tell the tale, too, I might add.
Barely.
Which you can ask Mom about that when you get home for Christmas. I'm going for broke tonight. Got the whole thing going with you and Mom. This will be my last show, but it's a good one. So anyway, meanwhile, back to, I don't want to get into that part of did you plan on being a mom all your life? Was this something you aspired to?
No, I was never one of those girls that had the dreams of the 2.1 kids. The picket fence and the husband were in the dream, but the children weren't. And actually, David and I really prayed about it for a long time. We'd been married 7 years and weren't sure if we wanted to have kids. We thought that it's something that we should do intentionally if we were going to do it. And just prayed very hard about it especially for a year, just concentrated, just didn't feel like I was getting any answers from God. And then actually had one specific day where it felt pretty obvious plank over the head that it was something that we should do. So there we go, hence Sienna.
And how has it been different than you expected it to be?
The connection, the sort of biological, instinctual connection, I didn't expect to have. I mean, everybody says you love your own kids, and I get that. But, like, the mother bear type of, like, lion tear your head off if you look cross-eyed at my child thing, I did not.
Let's move over, Bill.
Exactly. I did not expect.
A little too close to Sienna.
I didn't expect.
And the mother bear.
Yeah,
but it's been really powerful for you.
Yeah.
Well, what can you tell us about what you're going to do tonight?
Well, I just wanted to do some thoughts on Mary.
Okay.
Tonight.
Good.
Because I have been thinking a lot about Mary. And as a Protestant, you know, Presbyterian pastor, I know everybody breaks out in a cold sweat when you start talking about Mary. But she's been on my mind ever since last Christmas was when I found out I was pregnant. On Christmas Eve, actually, pregnant with Sienna. And so I had been looking in Scripture at that point to find other women who were pregnant and sort of think about their roles and how they dealt with it. And there's a lot of women who begat in Scripture, but there's not much mention of actual pregnancy, Mary and Elizabeth aside.
What does begat mean?
Yes, well, you know.
We're seminary graduates.
Yeah, exactly. They're begetting children, so they're, you know.
It's the past tense of begetting.
Okay. They have, you know.
Well, this is a profound one.
Mary really begat Jesus, and, you know, everybody's. It's genealogies, basically.
Okay,
Tamar begat whoever, all these, Bathsheba begat Solomon, these sorts of things.
Okay.
But there's more about Joseph I've found in the reactions to Jesus and Mary being pregnant than about poor Mary's ordeal. So this got me thinking more about Mary. So call me this liberal, crazy, feminazi person, but I wanted to hear a little bit more about
Liberal, crazy, feminazi person.
Yes,
go ahead.
I wanted to hear a little bit more about Mary, who bore God incarnate. So what is it like to carry the Son of God for 40 weeks? Was she throwing up her olives and hummus and only able to eat flatbread? I was so sick, I couldn't even go to Sundance. As you know, Dick, my favorite part of my job.
Yes, you canceled 2 days before, but let's not bring that up.
Pretty much. All I could eat were lemon drops and saltines. So I was wondering, was Mary like me? Did she want to choke people who were telling her to eat random things like ginger to make her feel better? And you know how she had to go about her daily business of cleaning and cooking and mending and tending? And I didn't want to move from the couch, so I'm wondering if she didn't want to move from her pallet for 4 months. This poor girl, you know nothing about her in Scripture. So because she's just a girl, she's enduring all of those maybe teenage angst, sideways glances, and gossip She possibly could have been stoned. That was not my experience being pregnant.
What kind of stoned?
Well, yeah, that was contemplated.
Jackie.
But, yeah, stoned.
I live on Orcas
yes,
now.
Stoned to death by rocks, you know, that for being pregnant without a husband. And I was wondering if it was worth it all. Was it worth it for her? Was it worth it when she first felt him kick? Did she think it felt like swallowing a river trout, like it did for me? And did her heart get gripped with fear when that little river trout stopped kicking for too long a time? So we know the rest of the story. Joseph doesn't leave her, and she heads to Elizabeth's for a little while. Did she finally get support at Elizabeth's? Did those sideways glances finally stop? Did anyone buy her a first century onesie for little Jesus? Did anyone make her Palestinian equivalents of tea cakes for her shower? And then we finally get to the heart of the story. You get to the one line in there after all of this from Luke's gospel. Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem because he was of the house of the family of David, in order to register along with Mary, who was engaged with him and was with child. And while they were there, the days were completed for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son. That's it. And wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in the manger. You can't help but notice that the geography gets more description than Mary's actual birth there. Okay, and Bethlehem's only 5 hours from Galilee walking. That's not that bad. I always thought it was much longer. I thought it was like days or something, but it's only 5 hours. But of course, she is the size of a harbor seal right now. So try, you know, strapping a bowling ball to your belly and walking for 30 minutes, let alone 5 hours. Or no, you know, strap her to a pack animal. That's better. That'll be more comfortable for her. I could barely ride a train to Portland for 3 hours. A train, let alone a donkey. So, what was she thinking? Having to go to Galilee. And of course, someone didn't call ahead for reservations for someone's very pregnant wife. And so someone else is now lying in the hay surrounded by
There's
sheep.
There's a feminazi bit coming
yeah,
out.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you suppose that? Let's have a Christmas feminazi moment.
Exactly. So here she's lying in the hay in excruciating pain, surrounded by sheep and cows and not midwives. Joseph's never seen a birth. He doesn't know what to do. How long was she in labor? Was it short? Was Jesus positioned correctly? I always hoped for the sake of Mary that because she was birthing God, that maybe she got an easy birth, that it didn't hurt so bad. But then I think, Jesus is fully divine and fully human, so the human part probably got in the way, and I bet she did not have the easiest of times. Hopefully the innkeepers took pity on her. Maybe the innkeeper's wife came out and brought her some of those swaddling clothes or some water. We don't know, because we're not cold. We're not told. We do know that it was not a silent night, however. Poor Mary pushes out this watermelon all on her lonesome, perhaps even wondering if she'll survive
it. Has Jesus ever been called a watermelon
before?
Yeah,
well, he just was by me. As
like
was this
shack.
One.
Presbyterian theology.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what it is.
It's all right. Brian will get up later and correct me. So she gets through all of this, and she has this wonderful little baby boy crying only the way newborns can cry. And she's crying and laughing, and her hormones are going crazy. So she's cold, and she's shaking, and she's burning up all the same. She's covered in blood. She's covered in muck. This is not the glowing, beautiful lawn nativity scene that we're so familiar with. So she's covered in all this stuff, and then what happens? She's in pain. She's finally recovering. A bunch of grubby field hands show up with their sheep to stare at her and possibly want to hold the baby.
Sterile situation.
Yeah,
of course.
I nearly kung fu'd my own mother when she held the baby for too long. My animal instinct kicked in so quickly.
Wow.
And I was clean. I had fresh sheets. I had access to a cafeteria. Oh, and yeah, okay, I had Percocet. So here's Mary. So Luke tells us after Mary has this grungy visit with these gropey shepherds, She treasured all these things in her heart. That's all we get on Mary's state of mind. But if Mary was anything like me, everything else was a blur, except the feel of those tiny fingers gripping her own, or those bright big eyes blinking up at her and the new world around her. The fresh, soft scent of a warm baby's forehead, and knowing, angels or no, that this child is destined for splendor. And speaking of splendor children, after this segment is over, I have to get this little one home and to bed and wonder how Mary got Jesus to sleep through the night without the use of a binky.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, big round of applause for the lovely Jenny. And Sienna has been so quiet.
Oh, merciful, merciful.
Let's put the microphone down and see if we can get her to make some noise.
Oh,
let me see if I can wake her
up.
Could
you pinch her?
Hi.
Can you giggle, honey?
You want to say something? Do you want to say anything?
Huh? Poker?
The American citizen.
Yeah.
Got that let's poker and see what happens. Well, it's been sweet. Well, let's have a big round of applause for the lovely Jenny. Thank you so much. That's great. That's really wonderful. And we look forward to having Jenny around next year. She's going to be very involved in these shows, and we're looking forward to that again. And she also appears in our movie show, which is not taped for a live audience, but is taped before this show every month. And she just did a major feature on Twilight. So if you want to know what Jenny has to think about Twilight, big round of applause for Jenny and Sienna. And we'll have some pictures posted at the website. I broke the rule. I turn on my cell phone. Well, next up, when we asked each of our guests or participants in the hearth to bring us something Christmassy, our next guest said, well, this is wintry, but not necessarily Christmassy. Let's have a big round of applause for Greg Wright. Gregory Wright. Greg is the editor of HollywoodJesus.com and also Pass the Popcorn, does amazing stuff as a film critic. And tell me about the piece that you decided to do tonight.
Oh,
yeah, I want to hear
about
it.
What do you want to know?
Well, tell me why you... First of all, it's a Robert Service piece.
Well, it's the only thing I have memorized, so, you know.
So for people who don't know who Robert Service is, who is Robert Service?
Robert W. Service was a former bank clerk who moved to the Yukon in the early part of the 20th century and became an overnight success when some of his yarns that he fabricated around the firesides and the bars up in the Yukon became a publishing sensation. And so I think anybody who grew up in the first half of the 20th century knew Robert W. Service inside and out, and that included members of my family. The poem of his, which I am going to recite, is kind of a family tradition in my family. My grandfather recited it at family gatherings, and my father did after him, and then I picked it up when I was in junior high. So I got this stuck in my head a long, long time ago, and it's never gotten out. So, you know, you're stuck with it now, too.
Excellent. Ladies and gentlemen, Greg Wright, and the poem is?
The Cremation of Sam McGee. There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was the night on the marge of Lake LaBarge. I cremated Sam McGee. Now, Sam McGee was from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows. Why he left his home down south to roam round the pole, God only knows. He was always cold, but the land of gold seemed to hold him like a spell, though he'd often say in his homely way that he'd sooner live in hell. On Christmas Day, we were mushing our way over the Dawson Trail. Talk of your cold, through the parka's fold, it stabbed like a driven nail. If our eyes we'd close, then our lashes froze, till sometimes we couldn't see. It wasn't much fun, but the only one to whimper was Sam McGee. And that very night, as we lay packed tight in our robes beneath the snow, and the dogs were fed and the stars overhead were dancing heel and toe, he turns to me and, "Caps," says he, I'll cash in this trip, I guess. And if I do, I'm asking that you won't refuse my last request. Well, he seemed so low that I couldn't say no. And he said with a sort of moan, it's this cursed cold, and it's got right hold till I'm chilled clean through to the bone. Yet 'tain't being dead. It's the awful dread of the icy grave that pains. So I want you to swear that, foul or fair, you'll cremate my last remains. Well, a pal's last need is a thing to heed, and I swore I would not fail. And we started on at the streak of dawn, but God, he looked ghastly pale. And he sat on the sleigh, and he raved all day of his home in Tennessee. And before nightfall, a corpse was all that was left of Sam McGee. There wasn't a breath in that land of death as we hurried, horror-driven, with a corpse half-hid that I couldn't get rid because of a promise I'd given. It was lashed to the sleigh, and it seemed to say, you may tax your brawn and brain, but you promised true, and it's up to you to cremate these last remains. Now, a promise made is a debt unpaid, and the trail had its own stern code. In the days to come, though my lips were dumb, in my heart, how I cursed that load. In the long, long night by the lone firelight, while the huskies, round in a ring, howled out their woes to the homeless snows. Oh, God, how I loathed that thing. And every day that quiet clay seemed heavier and heavier to grow. But on I went, though the dogs were spent and the grub was getting low. The trail was bad and I felt half mad, but I swore I'd not give in. And I'd often sing to that hateful thing, and it hearkened with a grin. Till I came to the marge of Lake LaBarge, and a derelict there lay. It was jammed in the ice, and I saw in a trice it was called the Alice May. I looked at it, and I thought a bit. Then I looked at my frozen chum, and here, said I with a sudden cry, is my crematorium. Some planks I tore from the cabin floor, and I lit the boiler fire. Some coal I found that was lying around, and I heaped the fuel higher. The flames just soared, and that furnace roared, such a blaze you seldom see. And I burrowed a hole in that glowing coal, and I stuffed in Sam McGee. Then I made a hike, for I didn't like to hear him sizzle so. And the heavens scowled, and the huskies howled, and the winds began to blow. It was hot, icy cold, but the hot sweat rolled down my cheeks, and I don't know why. And the greasy smoke in an inky cloak went streaking down the sky. I do not know how long in the snow I wrestled with grisly fear, but the stars came out, and they danced about ere again I ventured near. I was sick with dread, but I bravely said, I'll just take a peep inside. I guess he's cooked, and it's time I looked. And the door I opened wide. And there's that Sam looking cold and calm in the midst of that furnace roar. And he wore a smile you could see a mile, and he said, please close that door. It's fine in here, but I greatly fear you'll let in the cold and storm. Since I left Plumtree down in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been warm. There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The Northern Lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge, I cremated Sam McGee.
Woohoo! Now, Greg, Merry Christmas.
Happen on Christmas Day. Christmas Day, it's in there. It's a connection. It's snow.
Yeah.
Snow and Christmas.
So now, the first time you heard this was your grandfather?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did he do it like you did it? Did you pick up some of his stuff? What do you remember
I don't know.
As a kid?
I've done so many things.
Was your heart strangely warmed during Christmas season to hear your family carry on?
I have to tell you, this is no secret in my family. My grandfather was an extremely pompous man. He was the eldest child in a family of 11 children that were raised in a sod house on the plains of Alberta.
Wow.
So he was a tough bird and a very proud man. And one of his claims to fame, I mean, you read their diaries about what they did up on the plains of Alberta in the winters. I mean, they played a lot of what's that Canadian winter sport? Curling.
That's a Scottish sport.
That's a Swiss sport, right? Wait, it came from Switzerland.
Curling is from Switzerland. No, hurling is from Switzerland.
Curling is from Scotland.
So they did a lot of curling. They played a lot of cards, and they told a lot of tales. And my grandfather was very famous as a raconteur of sorts in that department. And I don't know. It was just something that was a family.
But it made an impression on you as a kid?
Yeah.
Hearing this stuff?
Yeah, sure.
And then your dad?
Gee, yeah. Yeah, because my dad never really learned it, so he'd only get little bits and pieces in there.
Really? So when did you first do it?
When I was in junior high. I was eighth grade. You know, you're supposed to memorize like an 8-line poem, and so I went off and did this 7-minute thing. So
I was reminded when you were telling that story, I interviewed Thomas Steinbeck, who is John Steinbeck's son, and he talked about. And this is something I think that's a lost art, which is why I think it's so special that this has been handed down from 3 generations. And I know, like, last year Dan Voetman said that they were doing a thing where everybody was learning a musical instrument, doing something family-oriented instead of... But Tom Steinbeck talked about what it was like to sit at home at night and listen to John Steinbeck tell stories.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
Just tell stories.
Well, Lord of the Rings, so many of the stories that the Inklings wrote were originated as oral tales and were intended to be read that way. And you listen to the recordings of Tolkien himself reading from passages of The Lord of the Rings. It's chilling. I mean, it's magical stuff. Yeah, the oral tradition is fantastic.
When he gets to Gollum, he does this. When Gollum says precious?
Yeah.
Tolkien in the recording goes precious like a snake. And it's just amazing what he does in his own reading of that material. That's amazing. Well, and by the way, for those of you that don't know, this show was actually inspired by the Inklings. When I first came back and talked to Mike Hale about doing this show, I said I was just over in Oxford, and I heard Anthony Flew, the world's leading atheist, describing how he was now a theist, and he was asked if he, and he's 90 years old, he'd written a classic religion textbook on how to teach religion as an atheist. And he was asked if he'd ever met C.S. Lewis, and he said, we used to go as Oxford students and sit as close as we could to the Inklings at the Bird and Baby pub just to overhear their conversation. And at that pub, they would read. Tolkien would bring a bit of Lord of the Rings that he was reading, and he'd read it, and Lewis would bring a little bit of Screwtape Letters, and Tolkien would say things like, you have no business writing this, you're not a theologian. And they sparked each other, and it was an amazing thing. And so that's fascinating. I wanted you to, interestingly enough, say a word about who's the man who's going to be with us next, because he's done a film called Expiration Date, and we happen to tape the film show tonight, and each of our film critics was asked to name a film that they would recommend people go buy on DVD, and you chose a film called Expiration Date.
Yes.
What can you tell us about it?
Well, earlier this year, just about a year ago, Hollywood came out with a tale featuring Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman about a couple of guys who grapple with the question, what do you do if you know you're going to die soon, called The Bucket List. And this film kind of dispenses with all the ridiculous star power and mega budgets and sort of out there postulations like, maybe I go have lunch on top of the pyramids in Egypt, and places it in a much more human context. Of a guy who believes he's going to die when he turns 25 because of some very humorous circumstances, and instead does things like maybe you and I might do, like have a garage sale, sell our stuff, raise the money to buy a casket, and go test out our future burial plot. It's a very, very lighthearted comedy. I came in contact with Rick because I have a passion for and common interest in alternative sources for films. Rick believes, and I agree with him, that the Hollywood machine kind of has a stranglehold on the delivery of the product, whether it's the theatrical releases or the quasi-independent films that are really produced and distributed by the studios for, I believe, the purpose just to make their films look better. today there are so many alternative sources for really good quality films out there. Independent filmmakers making low-budget but high-quality films. Rick's one of those filmmakers, and I think he's done a fantastic job with Expiration Date.
Let's have a big round of applause for Greg Wright and bring up filmmaker Rick Stevenson. Rick, good to have you with us. And Rick has been a friend for a while now. As a matter of fact, if you go to Nordstrom's this Christmas, you will see some films packaged there that Rick is the creative force behind. What? Tell me about that project. It really has to do with this distribution issue.
Yeah, it's called Official Best of Fest. And what most people don't know is that due to the stranglehold that Hollywood has on the theatrical business, only about one out of four of the best movies made around the world are ever allowed into the theaters. So if you think of your favorite film, and you think there's three more like it you've never seen, that's really upsetting. However, there's about 25,000 films made a year around the world, so how do you figure out which ones to see? So Official Best of Fest is pulling together all the top curators from the film festivals around the world, and we put together these little packs of films. So if you want to find out about it, you can go to www.officialbestoffest.com or go to Nordstrom and buy it.
And there some of the collections would include?
Oh, films to make you laugh, films to inspire, chick flicks.
Cool.
All sorts of fun ideas. Cool. Films about love.
Films
for kids.
Yeah. You got your start when you were at Oxford.
Yes.
Met a guy named David Putnam.
Yes.
And first film included Hugh Grant.
That was a stroke of luck. Yeah, absolutely.
You got the film bug. You were a Rhodes Scholar, I think.
I was a Rotary Fellow.
Rotary Fellow, and you were...
More lucrative, less prestigious.
But in economics.
Yes.
And got the bug and decided you had to make films.
That's right.
And the rest is history. Your first film, I think one of your first films was accepted at Sundance Film Festival. So you were
had three films at Sundance.
Three films at Sundance Film Festival. Rick's, he's been on the show before. If you put in the Kindling's Muse, those of you listening, go to the kindlings.com and then go to the search engine, put in Rick Stevenson, and you can hear a fuller explanation of his story. And it's an amazing story. And one of the things I have loved about Rick is his dad was, I think, a principal or a school superintendent in Shoreline, wasn't he?
For 20 years.
Yeah, and Rick's a real family guy. And what you're bringing to us tonight for Christmas is actually very family-oriented.
Yeah. Dick wrote us all that had been on the show and said, can anybody come bring any talent and songs? And I decided to spare you guys that. But I did sort of half-jokingly say, I have my Christmas letter. And before you all go racing to the door so that you don't hear about my son's basketball game, this is a little bit different, as you'll hear. So I just want to read it to you. She resembled Katharine Hepburn and he, William Holden. They shared a class together freshman year at Washington State University, her smile catching his eye, his kind decency catching hers. They exchanged a few shy words, but then one day he simply disappeared. He joined the Marines and got off to war. It was December 1942. The second time they saw each other was on a crowded city bus in San Francisco. Now in uniform, she was stuffed in the back, surrounded by girlfriends. He'd been the last on, and as he got off, he caught a glimpse of her and that unforgettable smile. Amazingly, she looked up just in time, saw him, and waved. But fate separated them once again. It wasn't until weeks later, on Halloween night, that the Marine commander ordered all Marines to attend a Halloween dance to keep them off the streets. It was there that they saw each other a third time and spent the rest of the night dancing together, their fates sealed before he shipped out to the South Pacific. Without these three chance meetings, I would not be here to tell this story about how my parents met. But it was my father's retelling of this story in August that put it all together for me. Mom had been in and out of hospitals and rehabilitation centers all year and was currently having a very rough time of it, barely conscious for days on end. My father had spent 12 hours a day sitting by her side, and this case was tenderly brushing her hair as she slept in the wheelchair. As he recounted this story, getting to the part about the dance, something beautiful happened. A small smile appeared on my mother's face, almost imperceptible but undeniable. I looked up at the nurse. She had seen it too, a faint version of that unforgettable smile. I looked back at them together, and with every brush of my mother's hair, suddenly saw the beauty of the entire universe all at once. I saw how things should be. I came home and told my wife Julie the story and sobbed, feeling so grateful for my life and family. My mother went home to God last week. We're all with her. She went peacefully, and nothing was left unsaid. Hours before she died, I kissed her forehead, and I told her it was okay to let go. I told her that if she understood, she could stick out her tongue. Sure enough, her tongue emerged from that gentle smile. She was with us to the end. Given all that's happening in the world, it's been easy to feel discouraged. The news is bleak, and the times are hard and scary. But I think, at least for me, something extraordinary is happening. As I'm stripped bare of my emotional defenses, drained of my security, as my abundance disappears and I have to make do with less, I am strangely feeling richer. Yes, richer. I feel a greater appreciation for what I have versus what I don't have. I gain clarity and find that there is less noise drowning out God's voice. I find that it's easier to see what really counts, and clearly what really counts is each other. Isn't that incredibly beautiful in its simplicity and its absolute attainability? For all of you, may out of these seemingly worst of times come the best of times. Blessing for 2009.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rick Stevenson. We're going to be back with more of the Kindling's Muse Christmas special coming up right after this. Don't go away. Be right back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being here tonight on the Kindling's Muse. I want to thank Rick Stevenson for being with us. And Rick, I want to mention, by the way, that last summer we had our first ever Kindlings Fest, and we had over 300 people. That was the capacity of the event on Orcas Island for Jerry Root speaking on the theme of the art of being fully human. Nigel Goodwin was with us doing a bag-in cafe every night. And the whole day, the whole rest of the day, other than a meal that we all enjoyed together, was basically to go out and get to know people and enjoy the beauties of Orcas Island. And it was such an amazing event last year. We're going to do it again this summer, and I'd like to invite all of you to make plans to be there. If you go to thekindlings.com and go to the Kindlings Hearth, there will be information there about registering for this summer's event, and we're going to add a second track. So we're going to take 600 people this summer. But among the people that will be there, Dr. Jerry Root's coming back again. Dr. Michael Ward, who wrote the book Planet Narnia, will be there. Nigel Goodwin will be there, and we'll have different tracks in the afternoon of optional events, and Rick Stevenson's going to do a filmmaker workshop at Kindlings Fest, and we'll be showing the film Expiration Date at the little theater there on Orcas Island. So be sure to check it out. It's July, I think, 22nd through something, Wednesday through Saturday, and there'll be more information coming about that. A lot of fun to have Rick here tonight. We also have another exciting piece of news from the Right Reverend Bill Hogg, pastor, humorist, and intergalactic evangelist. Bill, tell us, we were just off taping a little bit for a new venture that you're going to be involved in Canada.
Yeah, we're going to be pioneering the Kindlings in Canada, just across the line in beautiful BC, which is reputed to be the most beautiful place on planet Earth.
Other than Orcas Island and
Other
Scotland.
Other than Scotland. God's
Orcas
own country,
Island and Scotland.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But not in that order. And go figure. Anyway, we're going to have a Canadian flavor. Obviously, some issues are universal. Some issues are North American. But there are particular nuances and unique facets of life north of the 49th parallel. So very much looking forward to framing that hospitable, imaginative conversation about ideas that matter in Canadian life, and looking to launch just after the new year in January 2009.
He's going to have a cool banner, and he's going to have his own introduction, and then all the shows will be posted at thekindlings.com and at your own website as well. So that's really cool.
Right.
And who are you? Have a couple of panelists that you're going to have on an ongoing rotating basis.
On an ongoing basis, part of our panelist stable will be Peter Chataway, who doesn't have a life because he watches 500 movies a year. So he's kind of like this movie geek. He's like Jeff Overstreet, only he's Canadian and he has no life. And he's kind of the encyclopedia of movie knowledge. And probably after he listens to this, he'll quit.
Yeah, it's a great promotion for a show. One of our panelists has no life.
Had no life.
No personality.
I never said that. Yeah, I never said that. Yeah. So he's a Christian film critic and who's got an incredible encyclopedic knowledge of film. And John Stackhouse.
He's amazing.
Who's an amazing, robust, sharp, theological mind with a warm heart. And yeah. So he's a real asset at engaging in that intersection between faith and culture.
I've got to tell you on a personal note, I'm really excited that you're going to do this show. Because when Bill moved to Canada, a lot of you remember Bill used to be on this show regularly here at the pub. And always people loved him and appreciated him. And when he headed north, we felt a sense of loss. And now we feel a wonderful sense of gain because this is going to be a chance for you to kind of spread your wings and do something really exciting and mm-hmm. put your own stamp on the thing. And I'm looking forward to listening to the content because it's going to be great. I know they're going to be great shows. Now, you've brought something for us here tonight for our Christmas enjoyment.
Yes, I'm going to play a medley of Christmas carols on the bagpipes. And so at this point, Jenny Spohr will hand out earplugs for you. And this will be a Christmas never to forget. Actually, I'm going to share something probably just as moving as what our dear filmmaker friend shared.
Okay.
Top 10 ways you know you're having a dysfunctional family Christmas dinner.
Oh, good. Okay.
Okay. That's what I'm going to share.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill.
Hey, you're
welcome. So let's hear it. Yeah.
Okay. Number 10, your brother says to you, hey, what are you doing here? Number 9, after opening presents, everyone gathers around the piano and sings Louie, Louie. Number 8, the eggnog is sugar-free, low-cal, fat-free, low-sodium, and spiked with X-lax.
Are these like personal reflections? Are these memories from Scotland?
No, I was on the phone to Kathy Staub this afternoon, so these are... these are gleaned from the...
the Staub household.
The Staub
where people never shower.
That's right.
That's right, and X-lax is necessary.
That's right. The seventh way you know that you're having a dysfunctional family Christmas dinner is someone gave Uncle Bob a gun for Christmas, and he works at the post office. Okay, just a sympathy laugh there. Number 6, it's at a bowling alley. Number 5, the nativity has all Star Wars action figures in it.
Now, that's a good idea, actually.
Yeah.
And the Christian Wisdom of the Jedi Masters. It was for sale at a toll-free number. I like that.
That's right. And it sits as a centerpiece underneath the tree, just at the base of the tree, Christian Wisdom of the Jedi Masters.
That's very good. And that's mine, not his.
No, is that? Are you sure?
That's mine. Is that his?
That's mine.
Oh,
yeah.
Where's mine? Coming
it's
up.
Still, it's still ahead. Coming up because it's a dysfunctional family Christmas dinner.
Okay.
And someone cut off Uncle Dick half an hour ago. Number 4, the garland on the tree is made of carefully woven cigarette butts. Number 3, your family actually fights over who gets the fruitcake. The second way you know you're having a dysfunction family Christmas dinner is a guard knocks on the door and says, visiting hours over in 5 minutes.
Arrested development.
There you go. And number 1, Dad forgot the pizza again this year.
Ladies and gentlemen, top 10 reasons you know you're having a dysfunctional family Christmas. Well, coming up next, thank you, Bill. That was great. Marcy, come on up. Marcy O'Donnell is with us tonight. Marcy is a wonderful writer and poet and essayist and also has been one of the participants in our Kindling's Hearth events. These are by-invitation retreats where we ask different musicians and artists and writers to come together and try to listen to each other, have conversations about things that matter, and think about how we can rekindle an intellectual, spiritual, creative legacy and culture. And Marcy brings us a most interesting and unusual exploration of Christmas, a curmudgeonly Christmas. Do you think of it, now, do you have a microphone? She's set. Okay. Do you think of yourself as a curmudgeonly person in general?
No, maybe my family does. What inspired it was I tend to get depressed around Christmas time. I don't know if anyone else has that experience. Antidepressants are really great, I have to say. But when I wrote this, I didn't know the joys of the little white pill I take now. So I was in a sort of down
mood.
Ladies
and gentlemen, Montel Williams, Oprah, it's all here tonight.
I don't know. And it's self-explanatory, but the title of it is Let It Snow.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, a curmudgeonly Christmas.
There is a giant inflatable snowman on my next-door neighbor's front lawn, a six-foot-tall character made of parachute cloth, smiling vacantly and sporting a jaunty top hat. Last year, he stood alone, and this year, he has a little sidekick, another snowman, or snowboy, standing half his height. They are lit from within and brought to life by a mini generator timed to pump them up at 4 p.m. and to quit after midnight. During the day, they lay like deflated casualties. Upon inflation, their inane expressions cast benevolent benedictions toward the street, and their humming, glowing presence beams across the lawn to my living room bay window. I hate the snowmen. This emotion has taken me by surprise, having been taught that hate is a very strong word. I have stuffed and tamped hate way down inside. Now, this vile and unfamiliar emotion floods me daily as the light in the sky fades. I think I hate daylight savings time, too. And the white, blobby fatsoes come to life, heralded by the dim drone of the generator. I rush to the windows to close the blinds, hyperventilating involuntarily. More Scrooge-like with every passing day, I grit my teeth as other neighbors retrieve ladders and extension cords, place jolly plastic Santas and grazing wire reindeer out in view, and gradually light up our small cul-de-sac with unique displays of colored lights, all sizes, some blinking, some in the shape of stars or candy canes, some outlining the gables. The cheerier the night becomes, the more curmudgeonly I feel. A small part of my peak is a reasoned reaction to holidays turned commercial, drained of meaning, forced, and ultimately tiresome. But mostly I am irrationally peeved that the tacit agreement on the street seems to be that everyone should put something out, no matter how tacky the display or how irrelevant to anyone's true beliefs concerning this season. I am aggravated that people on our street, mostly the men, have...
Men are getting it tough tonight.
I didn't know.
Another feminazi has appeared on the show.
Yeah.
Well, they
sorry,
have
Marcy.
Somehow the time and the inclination to create this light parade, working doggedly on ladders and rooftops, risking trips to the emergency room. I never see women out on ladders or on rooftops. This is man territory, holiday smackdown. My next door neighbor took the safe route, planting his snowman on the front lawn, no climbing involved. But if he pipes in music, I will have to get out my husband's childhood BB gun and disable the snowman forever. Frosty and Son are surrounded by colored lights. These border their driveway and the still green lawn. I imagine a merry landing strip for miniature aircraft. I grew up in Cleveland, where there is plenty of snow all winter. After the true excitement of the first snowfall, the reality of four or more months of white turned to gray slush piled high on streets and in parking lots sobers excitement for adults. Many more minutes are added to travel, including the time needed to suit up to brace for cold blasts. My two-block walk to elementary school back in the 60s felt like 20 blocks as the wind whipped into a frenzy over the flat land. Sidewalks and other footpaths turned alternately mushy, then icy, and deep footprints served as guides through 2 to 3 foot drifts. These tracks became semi-permanent if no fresh snow fell and the temperature remained below freezing. But, oh, the compensations for kids. Skating, tobogganing, snow forts, giant icicles. Through our large living room window, I could see trees, rock garden, patio furniture in our backyard piled high with pristine beauty and all sculpted with snow. My granny wanted the snowscape untouched until a thaw, so she could enjoy the sacrosanct postcard view. Mother and granny forbade any playing in the backyard. Under the picnic table, I could see the most amazing natural snow fort. Weirdly, this was declared off limits every year, along with the rest of the available packing snow in the backyard. I still bemoan all my lost snow opportunities, but I could trample the front yard without a care. Granny had no good view from inside the house to the front yard. And I made real snowmen, big ones too, until they melted. But there is no snow where I live now. Or, more correctly, snow falls only about one day a year. This stops everything. All traffic, all commerce, all education. No preparations for these rare snowfalls are made. Most of us stay home, tuning into local TV news footage of the few intrepid unfortunates who think they can navigate icy, hilly roads in their all-wheel drives. We watch in comfort as they crash into telephone poles and each other. The ground cover lasts a couple of days, tops, and supplies only a snowball fight or two, or part of a snowman, certainly not one of the size looming next door. All of the current holiday lighting and absurd figures on our street are set against a backdrop of green. Lawns finally greening up after the summer heat. Lush shrubbery, evergreen trees and hedges. This feels wrong. If I cannot have snow for a backdrop, I want all the lights to go away instead. In past years, I placed electric candles in each window of our home, calm, understated symbols of celebration. This year, in silent and grumpy protest of Frosty and Son, I have refrained. Our house is as dark as the others are lit. A single wreath hangs beside the front door. I have an intense dislike of peer pressure, and I hate the Frosties. I will do a minimum of decorative celebration inside my house, and when the season ends, hibernate until spring, when I can wave a happier greeting to my neighbors as we do our yard work. Then, lengthening sunlit hours will put me in a better mood, and no one will be lighting up our block. Bah humbug.
Woohoo! Thank you, Marcy. This is fun. Well, Robert Diebel was at the very first Kindling's Muse we ever did here at Hales, and he's a well-known Seattle artist, musician, and also appeared on our recent show on The Shack in a discussion where he looked at it from his additional profession of late, which is as a therapist, and a particular concern for helping counsel artists. And we're really pleased that Robert has been at one of our Kindling's Hearth, and he was at Kindling's Fest this summer. Hopes he can be back in next summer. Robert, what do you got for us here tonight?
Frosty the Snowman.
Okay, let's all
was a very
let's all
unhappy
lay down like little
soul.
Inflatables, and then
with a cold drop kite, a bit untied, and his Prozac running low.
Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Diebel, let's hear it for him.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be far away. Here we are as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together if the fates allow. Hang a shining star upon the highest bough, and have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
Well, that was fun. We now have Brian Burton is going to come and share with us tonight. And Brian has been on a number of shows over the years. Theologian, studied in Ireland.
Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland.
Yeah, you're
real. I have to say that. My wife's here.
Ah.
Belfast.
Belfast, Ireland.
Yep.
What was Christmas like in Belfast?
Very different. It's sweet. It's got all the charm that one would expect of it. It's with my wife's family, who, again, it's crazy making. Very different than how we celebrated it in my own family. And it had all the good things that you'd want in Northern Irish Christmas. It was kids going crazy and the joy of it all and being with family. And yet a great deep respect on Christmas morning. It was one of the great joys to have all the kids just come and bring their presents, come to church, and people just came far and wide. And it had Irish people are down to earth. That's the best way I can put it. And it was fantastic to celebrate Christmas.
And your wife's name?
Caroline.
Caroline from Northern Ireland?
From Northern Belfast? Ireland. And actually, her name's that because she was born the day after Christmas.
Wow.
26th of December. So that's why she got the name Caroline. She was a right after Christmas baby. So,
wow. How'd you guys meet?
We actually met in Southern California, of all crazy places.
Everyone thinks we
met in Ireland, but we didn't. She showed up in a church where I was a youth pastor, and we kept everything a secret, and we met at Thanksgiving, actually. So we just celebrated our meeting for the first time at Thanksgiving, and within 5 months, we were engaged, and 11 months later, we were married, and we've been married 27 years now. So.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So you had already been to Ireland before you met?
No.
So you went back to Ireland after you...
Went back after we met. Part of her family came over for the wedding in Southern California, and then I was starting to look at doctoral work, and we went over for a visit over in Belfast and then to Scotland. Bill?
Way to go. Yeah,
Aberdeen.
Good choice.
Aberdeen was wonderful. Cold in June, though.
Yeah, well, it sits on the North Sea. Should have been in Glasgow. European city of culture.
Well, it wasn't the European center of culture at the time, my friend. It's kind of come up in the world, as has all of Ireland. So,
I don't know if I can speak authoritatively about the all of Ireland part of your sentence there, but yes, Scotland. Glasgow, European city of architecture and design, and also European city of culture. There you go. I rest my case, Your Honor.
Well, I stand with Thomas Cahill, so sorry, my friend. The Irish did save civilization.
But remember, Patrick was actually a Scot born just outside Dumbarton, so technically it was the Scots that saved civilization because...
Well, if Braveheart was right, that Irishman really helped the whole Scottish cause.
But Braveheart wasn't right. It was Hollywood fantasy.
Okay,
The battle scene was shot in a golf course in Ireland because it was more tax beneficial for we male to take the production team across there. But it's just Hollywood fantasy. We know very little about William Wallace. So I just thought I'd put you straight on that, Brian, before you dig a large cultural faux pas grave for yourself.
Well, maybe we can come back on St. Patrick's Day and we'll all talk about this again.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it, everybody?
Yeah.
We're a few holidays ahead of ourselves now.
Wow. Just a little preview of things to come in 2009. Okay.
And I did appreciate Bill's attempt at his own contemporary version of Robbie Burns. That was fantastic. I can't think of a better 10 dysfunctional signs of a family Christmas than that. That was a Robbie Burns brought to contemporary times. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for being tuned in, Brian. God bless you. God bless you. God blesses one and all.
Auld Lang Syne and all that.
Okay, so now turning the corner from the ridiculous to the sublime.
Yes.
You wanted to bring us something from Carl Barth.
I did.
Tonight.
So I guess that brings it. When you first called and asked, or emailed and asked about this night, tonight, 40 years ago tonight, Carl Barth passed away, probably one of the greatest theologians in the church's history. And before I read what I want to read, what's really important was the last words we have from Carl Barton. He had come to the States in 1962, and he's written tons and tons of work through the years. And he came and he was giving these great lectures at Princeton, University of Chicago, all these places. And somebody asked him, in the end of the day, for all the things you've written, all the things you've said about the Christian faith, how would you summarize it? And I think this showed the sign of the man. He started saying, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." And on the night he passed away, one of his lifelong friends, Edward Turnerson, called him. And it was 1968, December 8th, 1968. And the world was in great turmoil, much in, like our own times. And his friend Turnerson kind of was just talking about how bad the world was, what a mess it was in Europe, the state of the church and its inability to address the issues of the day, and even their own lives as they were growing older and their health was waning. And the last words we know Karl Barth spoke was, he said, "Edward, don't ever forget Christus Victor. Christ is victorious." And to me, that really summarizes not only the man, but he was considered this great theologian, but what a lot of people don't know is that he, almost every week he was in town, he preached to the prisoners at Basel Prison. And what I wanted to share tonight was his last Christmas sermon, a snippet from his last Christmas sermon to the prisoners of Basel. It's a powerful word preached 50 years ago, almost to the date, based on the text, "And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn." And this is just a brief section from that sermon. "My dear brothers and sisters, let me get to the main point without delay. Who is he who was born the son of Mary wrapped in swaddling clothes and laid in a manger? Who is he? I do not ask who he was. Christmas is not the birthday celebration of a person who lived long ago, then died and passed away, and whose centennial we solemnly commemorate. True, he once lived and then died, and how he died. But he also, true, rose from the dead. He lives and is present among us now, much closer to each one of us than we are to ourselves. Still, who is he? The answer to this question is the good news of Christmas. Today, let me say simply this. He who was born in the stable is he who stands by you, stands by me, and stands by us all. I do not say one who stands by you, but he who stands by you. For only one, only he who was born on that first Christmas day, can stand by us in utter unselfishness and with ultimate authority and power. I would like to state this to you in very personal terms. He stands by you, and by you, and by you. This is the good news of Christmas. He who stands by you and helps you is alive and present. It is he who was born that Christmas day. Open your eyes. Open your ears. Open your heart. You may truly see, hear, and experience that he is here and stands by you as no one else can do. He stands by you, really by you, now and forevermore. He stands by you without ulterior motive, without thinking of himself. But now the good news of Christmas. He who was born on Christmas Day stands by you without thinking of himself for one moment. He does not demand anything from you. He demands you. Love caused thine incarnation. Love brought you down to me. Your thirst for my salvation procured my liberty. O love beyond all telling that led you to embrace, in love all love excelling, our lost and fallen race. He is the one who was born that Christmas morning and became your fellow traveler par excellence, your neighbor, your friend, your brother. He reaps no benefit from it. He is not concerned with himself. He is concerned only with you. He stands by you in the fullness of his authority and power. And now the good news. He who was born on Christmas Day is not only the Son of Mary, he is also the Son of God. If he stands by you, he does so in full power, in the power to help you at any cost. to shield you against each and every one, above all against your worst enemy, yourself. He stands by you in the power to help you effectively, to carry you, to save you. He is not content to bring you some comfort and good cheer. He is all out to bring you everlasting joy. Only he can bring it, but he really does bring it. He stands by you in the power to guide you through this life and to carry you through death to life eternal. It is he who was born on Christmas Day, your Savior and mine, the Savior of us all, the first son of Mary, the firstborn of all creation. As it is affirmed elsewhere in the Bible, he, Christ the Savior, is born.
Wow. That's Karl Barth, the last Christmas sermon.
Last Christmas sermon he preached in the Basel prison to prisoners there. And he did that throughout his life, and very few people knew it. And what a powerful witness it is.
Dr. Brian Burton, this is Dick Staub, back with more of the Kindling's Muse coming up right after this. Don't go away. That's David Benoit, if you're wondering. And it's great to have all of you here tonight. This has been a lot of fun. Actually, after we did this last year, I just thought, man, how are we ever going to have something as interesting as this year? And this year's just been great. I've totally enjoyed it. And it's we say that the Kindlings are thoughtful creatives. And Bill and Carlo and I were just talking about the fact that one of the things that we have found is that thoughtful creatives really bring people together with their creativity. And Carla was saying there's been surprises here tonight. We didn't know what people were going to bring. And it's been really a lot of diversity, and it's come from all sorts of different places. And it's just a reminder of how amazing God's imprint is on human beings, that everybody's created in the image of God, and everybody has something to bring. You know, and if we had the time, we could go around, and everybody here tonight could share something. I was actually thinking, while Brian was talking about Karl Barth, and that was amazing to hear Karl Barth's words at Christmas. Just last Monday night, we at the Earl Palmer Ministry Show, the Kindling's Muse at Earl Palmer Ministries, which is over at Burke Museum Cafe, we did a show on Bonhoeffer's letters and papers from prison. And of course, he was a protege of Barth. And when you read letters and papers from prison, Earl chose the poems that Bonhoeffer wrote, and most of them were at Advent. And one of the things that he said is so Barth-like. He said, "I'm sitting in prison." Well, I've actually got the exact quote here. Why don't I let Bonhoeffer say it, because he'll say it better. Most of you know that he could have stayed in the United States. He was a German, had already written Cost of Discipleship, Living Together, went to Union Seminary, and was able to stay in the United States, but chose to go back to Germany to take a stand with the confessing church against Hitler. And in 1943 was put in prison, and in 1945 was hung the day before the British liberated that prison camp. And it's so eerie to hear the comparisons of Karl Barth, because Bonhoeffer's last act was serving communion to the prisoners. And he served communion. The guards came and said, "Come with us." And everybody knew that meant he was going to be killed. And he turned to a guy named Payne, who was a British officer, who was distraught that Bonhoeffer, because he'd been a real spiritual glue for the prisoners. And Bonhoeffer turned to him, and the last words that he said were, "This is the end. For me, it is the beginning of life." And that was the kind of people that Karl Barth kind of influenced. And one of the things that Bonhoeffer led Bonhoeffer to go back to Germany was he had written these words. He said, "The responsible man seeks to make his whole life a response to the question and call of God." And he didn't feel like he could allow his fellow German Christians to be forced to take an ethical stand while he lived in the safety of the U.S. and had a nice seminary job. The other thing, though, that I was the moment that reminded me so much of Bart is that he talked about when he was in prison, he came to the realization that while we think of ourselves as people who seek God, he said it was in prison that he came to realize that it is God who came to seek us. And he wrote this during Advent. And he saw his imprisonment as a metaphor for understanding Advent. And this is what he said. Advent, where one waits and hopes and potters about, but in the end, what we do is of little consequence, for the door is shut and can only be opened from the outside. And he sat in prison and realized there's a door that's shut and I can't open it. Somebody else would have to come open it. And he realized that Christ coming to earth, the Word becoming flesh, was the door being opened from the outside and giving us a chance to walk through that open door into God's fellowship and presence. It's a beautiful thing, and that's got Karl Barth written all over it, the Bonhoeffer story. So Advent is a time, just like this evening has been, of a lot of laughter and a lot of fun and a lot of fellowship and a lot of warmth. It's also always been a time of a lot of pain and a time when convictions were expressed in difficult circumstances. And I think this year, a lot of people are being given a chance to think about what really matters with the economy and all the things going on around us. And we're all having to step back and say, what have we been about as Americans? And what has meant the most to us? And what have we been placing our hope in that is sinking sand? And what is the real foundation of life? And it's getting us stripped back to the bedrock stuff, and that's a good thing, but it's a painful thing. So we really enjoyed this evening. We're going to end in just a minute with our new ukulele band, which I can hardly wait to hear. These guys look like a bunch of escaped convicts with Stradivariuses in their hands. But it's, sorry, guys. But we're gonna sing some Christmas carols. But before we do, another Kindling, another guy who's been to these shows from the very beginning, has been a real friend of the Kindlings, and also has been at one of our Kindlings' hearth. He owns an ad agency. He writes a lot of jingles, ones that you know and hear. As a matter of fact, nauseatingly can't get out of your head when you're taking a shower the next morning, and that's good for his clients. And Dan Voltman's going to bring us some stuff tonight. Let's hear a round of applause for Dan.
One of the things I love about Christmas is that it's the one time of the year when everybody's talking about Jesus. The only sad part about it is that most of them don't get beyond the Jesus of the manger to talk about the Jesus who lived and who died and those kinds of things. So this song, this first song I like to sing is about that topic of who is Jesus. Some say he was an outlaw, that he roamed across the land with a band of unschooled ruffians and a few old fishermen. No one knew just where he came from or exactly what he'd done, but they said it must be something bad that kept him on the run. Some say he was a poet, that he'd stand upon the hill, and his voice could calm an angry crowd or make the waves stand still. That he spoke in many parables that few could understand, but the people sat for hours just to listen to this man. Some say he was a sorcerer, a man of mystery. He could walk upon the water, he could make the blind men see. That he conjured wine at weddings, did tricks with fish and bread. that he talked about being born again, raise people from the dead. Some say a politician who spoke of being free. He was followed by the masses on the shores of Galilee. He spoke out against corruption and he bowed to no decree. And they feared his strength and power, so they nailed him to a tree. Some say he was the Son of God, a man above all men. But he came to be a servant and to set us free from sin. And that's who I believe he was, 'cause that's what I believe. And I think we should get ready before it's time for us to leave. The song I'd like to do is one that, actually it's only going to do one song tonight because we have all this ukulele band stuff to do, but over the weekend I was listening to Christmas tunes. I have about 1,200 of them on my iPod, so you plug it into the stereo and about every 2 days you go over and press restart and that's about it. And we must have been in the John Denver section because I heard a song I haven't heard for a long time by John Denver. I don't hear it on the radio, I guess, but it's just a beautiful song that just really expresses kind of the love of a father and kind of what happens at Christmas time. He wrote it for his son, Zachary, when his son was born. So just a beautiful little tune. The season is upon us now, a time for gifts and giving. And as the year draws to its close, I think about my living. The Christmas times when I was young, the magic and the wonder. But the colors have dulled and candles dim, darkness instead of wonder. Oh, little angel, shining light, you've set my soul to dream. You've given back my joy in life and filled me with new meaning. A Savior King was born that day, a baby just like you. And as the Magi came with gifts, I come with my gifts too. That peace on earth fills up your time, that brotherhood surrounds you, that you may know the warmth of love and wrap it all around you. It's just a wish, a dream I'm told, from days when I was young. But Merry Christmas, little Zachary. Merry Christmas, everyone. Merry Christmas, little Zachary. Merry Christmas, everyone.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask our ukulele band to come up to the front now. And this is the moment we've all been waiting for, especially the ukulele players. Now, Dan, why is it that you were inspired to bring six ukuleles tonight?
Well,
okay, thank you for that answer.
Yeah, my wife will tell you, if you walk around our house, we've got musical instruments all over the place, because I'm Dan, and I'm addicted to music. So, but I just like picking up different things. And after one of our trips to Hawaii, I picked up a ukulele and thought, well, that's a lot of fun. And then I saw the DVD about the memorial concert for George Harrison. And everybody kept coming up with ukuleles. Paul McCartney sings something with it, and Eric Clapton and Joe Brown. And anyway, the long and the short story, but I checked into it, and it turned out that every time when you went to George Harrison's house, he always made all of his friends sit around and pick up ukuleles and play ukuleles as part of the evening, because George's philosophy of life, well, he had many, this is one of them, George's philosophy of life was that you couldn't be unhappy if you're playing a ukulele. So that was his thing. So he had a bunch of ukuleles, so at his memorial concert, everybody played on ukuleles to honor him. And I thought, what a fun idea, so I started collecting ukuleles, and anyway, this is the result of that.
Somebody just brought me a ukulele.
I get to play in the ukulele band. I'm very moved by this.
Well, let's find out who our band is. What's your name?
Lyle George.
How long have you been playing ukulele?
Oh, about 25 minutes.
Okay, excellent. Good. What's your name?
Nathan.
Nathan, where are you from?
Here.
From Seattle, from Hales. You live here? Good. Yeah. The every man's dream. Just to live in a place like this. Yeah. And so, have you ever played the ukulele before?
Yeah, about 25 minutes ago.
Excellent. Good. And now we come to this fine young man. What's your name?
Mostyn.
Mostyn? Mostyn from Boston. Austin. And you actually are a professional musician.
Not a ukulele player.
So there's a difference? Okay, you actually went to a very famous music school out in Boston.
I did.
It is?
It's called Berklee.
Wow. Are you going to play a solo?
No.
Okay, good. You can see the ukulele band is really excited to be up here tonight. I've never seen such enthusiasm from such grown men. Hi there.
Hi.
What's your name?
Bill Hoglum.
And you've played the ukulele for years?
Years, starting 25 minutes ago.
Okay, the 25-minute ukulele band, and I actually have not had the 25 minutes, so I've actually not played a ukulele before, but I'm going to do it. And Dan, you're going to lead us?
Leading always has something to do with followers. I'm not sure we're going to have the follower part.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to actually be here now because I have to read the chord sheet. What? So now you have at your tables, you have a couple of Christmas carol things there. What are we singing first?
Way in a Manger.
Okay, and we've got ukuleles.
Yeah,
and we're all tuned up.
And you're gonna
be a roving. What are you doing, Carlo? Please. Wow. The evening gets more exciting. What are you doing? Well, I don't want to sing. I don't want to be on the microphone when I'm singing. Okay.
Now, and the one request I did make of Dick is, I said I arranged all of these in a key structure that other people could sing, not me. So I need to
wait. Okay.
Oh, you're.
Wait, mine is out of tune.
You are out of tune. that didn't sound at all like my.
This
dog
is
has,
what happens
please.
When you don't have 25 minutes of experience. Could somebody give me a? Am I going to break it if I?
No, go for it.
That sounds like George Harrison, doesn't it? My sweet Lord. Okay. And
yeah. A little Ravi Shankar music here.
This isn't really holding a tune.
That's the.
This is the bad one?
That's the reason nobody else here chose it.
Okay, so I'm getting the leftovers.
You weren't there.
Okay. Was this in tune at one time? This, of course, will all be on the podcast, right? Oh, good, good. I mean, it just does not hold a tune.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to.
Okay. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to be able to play. Because it won't hold a tune. Oh, my gosh. What's happening? What? That's right. Okay, you could edit this out of the show if you'd like. Okay, good. What's this?
You're still plugged in. Okay.
Okay. But right, just so you know that I'm not trying to beg out, I'll play you what the first chord sounds like on this one. Would you like to play us the G actually on a ukulele? Yeah, and here it is on this one. Okay, so this is the ukulele from the 60s after a really, really bad, bad experience trip, yeah.
All right.
Okay, so.
All right, so we're going to just do the first and the last verse of the three choruses we're doing. So the first one is Away in a Manger, and we'll go, everybody ready?
Yep.
Okay, one, two, three.
On the way in a manger,
the 25 minute ukulele band.
Just imagine we could do with an hour.
Yeah, just imagine how good they could be if they practiced.
All right, Joy to the World is our next one here. Again,
okay.
First and last verse.
Joy to the world.
Gentlemen, a big round of applause for the 25-minute ukulele band. And I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight. I was reading a comment by Helen Keller about Christmas, who, of course, she was blind, and she said, the only real blind person at Christmas time is he or she who has not Christmas in their heart. So let's go out of this place tonight with Christmas in our heart. Thank you, 25-Minute Ukulele Band. We are expecting you back next year. We know you're going to be asking for a raise. And thank all of you for joining us tonight on the Kindling Smuse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub for our Christmas special. Woohoo! Well, that was fun.